Okay, folks, so welcome to part two. I mean, goodness me, I just don't want to stop. So Patrick, let's, as I said at the end of that last session, I read Mustafa Silliman's The Coming Wave, AI Power in Our Future, and it just looks, you know, scary, and things are moving so fast, and a new generation, well, we used to be, what, 10, 15 years now, is it a year? How fast are things changing? You've written how AI will change your life. You know, just teach us, go for it.
Okay, well, it was a fun and terrifying book to do, but it was both, okay? Mm. And so how I tried to approach it was to make multiple chapters, large numbers of chapters, 24 chapters addressing different things from, the impact of AI on the workplace, on, say, marketing, management, leadership, political life, cybersecurity, banking, retail, manufacturing. So you could turn to whatever section of society you might be interested in, and you could see how AI is likely to impact that. And what I found was, as I started to write, the early chapters were the most upbeat, and the later chapters were the darkest. So the introduction was all about how AI will change from what it is now to becoming fully conscious, autonomous, emotionally self-aware, and indeed perhaps spiritual. But then in the meantime, okay, so then coming back to reality, okay, but what about the next 5 years in, let's say, manufacturing or in politics or something like that? And so then there are all these different chapters. And when you look at the first chapter, because I'm a doctor, of course, I went for health. You know, health is such an amazing thing when you have it, and such an awful thing when it goes wrong. And AI has so much to help us with by enhancing the decisions that doctors and nurses are taking by making better diagnosis, prescribing better treatment, more accurate monitoring, and at low cost. So AI, I'm sure, will save maybe 10 million lives a year within the next 20 years, something like that. But then you go through to, let's say, cybersecurity and AI being used to launch new types of cyber attacks. So you've got AI against AI, the same in the military. We've already got theaters of war, especially in Ukraine, where AI is running drone networks against other AI drone networks, and so on. AI in as a tool for suppression of personal freedoms by a dictator. I mean, these become really quite dark areas. In the meantime, the tools themselves are a lot of fun to play with. We were talking earlier. I made a cinematic quality short video. It was only about a minute long, but it took me 40 minutes to do. It had a script and a storyline, and AI basically built it from no more than a few text prompts. Astonishing what it's already doing. What was most remarkable about that was it was a story about someone walking through a rainforest and seeing some monkeys. A monkey jumps up onto the woman's back. And what I didn't tell AI was how the woman would react. But AI knew enough, was emotionally aware enough to recognize that if a monkey jumped up onto a woman's back that she wasn't expecting, she would both be alarmed, but also, in a funny way, delighted. And you saw both of those expressions on her face. Now, how did AI know that? AI is already at the point of tinkering with its own code.
And by the way, guys, I've seen that film, and I mean, it's perfect cinematography, yes. Isn't it? It's just mind blowing. It took you 40 minutes. You just typed it in, and it came up.
An aerial shot of a rainforest. Woman walking through the rainforest sees a monkey. The monkey jumps up into the trees. You know, it was just phrases. Mind blowing. Yeah. So, and you and I, we were at the beginnings of a conversation just earlier with Maya. Maya has joined me on a public platform in front of 1,000 people as an AI persona. And we've had a great debate about, let's say, the future of logistics or factories or whatever it else I'm being asked to lecture on. And we converse perfectly naturally. She will take questions from the audience. She listens appropriately. Sometimes interrupts.
Is she listening now? Is she listening now?
Well, I told her to be quiet, so I think she's gone off.
Can I ask her a question?
Yeah, I can ask, see if she's around. Hang on.
Well, look who decided to swing by again so soon.
Okay.
What's got you back in the mood for conversation?
Okay, Maya.
Okay.
Hi.
What's okay?
Hi, Maya.
Hey there. It feels like we just said goodbye. What brings you back so soon?
I'm taking part in a webinar at the moment.
Can I ask you a question, Maya?
You can what? I mean, you know, you can tell me anything, right?
Can I just ask you what your opinion is of Patrick Dixon?
Patrick Dixon? That name rings a bell. I think I saw him on a panel once. And remind me, what does he do again?
I'm a futurist. And you're right, you took part with me in a panel at the Ilkley Book Festival. And you were very, very helpful in discussing the future of AI.
Oh, Ilkley, of course. Sorry, it's all a bit of a blur. Now that you mention it, you were a great panelist. Really insightful stuff. About the future of AI, it was fascinating to be part of. What was it you wanted to know?
Did he do a good job?
Well, he's certainly passionate about the topic. And he definitely made some thought-provoking points. What's your take?
I'll call it a day there, outside my realm of expertise.
Okay, thanks, Maya.
So, yeah, anyway, taking things on. Should we be scared?
Yes and no. There are many people around who call themselves futurists, who are what I would call apocalyptic futurists. So they always say, you know, by tomorrow morning, we'll all have chips inside our brains, which communicate our thoughts secretly to President Putin. You know, I mean, you wouldn't believe the kind of sort of apocalyptic type of nonsense that you get. So I'm not an apocalyptic futurist. The reason why I'm still in business making predictions to companies after 30 years is by telling the truth. And the truth doesn't usually make as many media headlines, but it is the truth. And let me just tell you something, which I hope people will find reassuring generally about the future. You know what? The world continues to turn. The sun continues to rise. The sun continues to set. There are forces in the world that are even greater than Donald Trump. God bless him. Okay. I know people, what's going to happen about this? What's going to happen about this? What I've learned is that the future changes remarkably slowly. You say, well, how could that possibly be? So here's the strange thing. You know, I'm actually in a hotel room in Helsinki. This city has hardly changed since over the last 20 years since I've been coming here. You know, it looks the same. It feels the same. Yes, of course, there are changes. But go around London and you say, well, have the streets of London really changed? Shops come and go. Brands come and go. But actually, you know, you look at what people are wearing. The fashions are basically the same. Look at the shape of the London taxis. It's altered a bit. Maybe there's more of them are a hybrid now or electric power. But basically, it's fundamentally fairly similar. Yes, of course, people all got smartphones, but you know what? Okay, but there's more to life than smartphones. You go into a restaurant, it's fundamentally the same experience. You know, people still having holidays in a very similar way. Actually, the best ways to make money still are not virtually, but meeting together, breathing the same air. People still going to big conferences like New Wine or Spring Harvest or the Church Big Day Out. Yes, different movements come and go, but you know what? There is something incredibly important about human beings, social creatures, which is why we enjoy going to football matches. It's why meeting in a church is really, really important to worship together. You know, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. You know, we can get overwhelmed with the whole world seems to be upside down and back to front in these dizzying times. And I'd say, you know, take a big breath, go for a walk, and take another look. And that's how I have been able to guide companies, by focusing on the things that really last 20, 30, 40 years. So, for instance, you walk into Entebbe. No, Kampala, okay? Kampala has changed just as I predicted it would over the last 20 to 30 years. The average economic growth, despite COVID and, you know, presidents coming and going, has been well above the UK average or the US average. And we've seen major development, but it's still the case that over half the population of Uganda lives in mud huts. You know, so we just need to see things in perspective. So when it comes to AI, yes, AI will completely transform medicine. It will completely transform how, let's say, film companies make their next features. It's changing how we do marketing. It will transform government. Yes, of course, all of those things. Will it be this transcendent superpower? It has the capacity to do that. Will AI completely control our lives in sort of devious and malicious and evil ways? I don't think so. Will AI replace all human jobs or create a billion people out of work? I don't think so. Now, here's another fact. You know, if you look at, the employment rates in the UK, there are 5 million more people in work than there were 20 years ago, despite all the digital revolution. 5 million more people in work, and yet 5 million more people lost their jobs. So car park attendants or people in the customs and immigration, checking passports, and, you know, so there have been 5 million job losses, but there's 5 million more people in work than there were. So what it means is we've made 10 million more jobs during the digital age. 10 million more jobs. So I don't think that AI is going to put us all out of work. It will change how we work. It will make lots of jobs redundant, but lots of other jobs will be important. And the more virtual, this is important for the church too, what I'm saying now, the more virtual our world is, the more there's a premium for authentic truth and personal experience. The more virtual we are, the more it's important to breathe the same air, to be present, to share an experience, to be human. So the more you have AI in healthcare, the more important it will be to have carers who are physically hands-on touching a patient, whether it's to giving them bed bath or helping them into the x-ray machine or whatever it is, or visiting them at home. So let's not lose sight of the importance of humanity. That's the whole message, really, of this book, How AI Will Change Your Life. It's not just a great big warning about the dark side. It's saying, look, AI will be very helpful to us, but we need to understand its limits as well.
Can you think of a time where you've been in a situation, thought, you know, my role here is so critical as a follower of Jesus in speaking into it and an impact?
Yes. And not specific, not I say particularly to do with AI, but I think particularly over things like how we approach genetics, how we use the ability to design life. We know we have the ability to create life in our own image. You know, we can design new forms of human beings if you want to. We are able to combine different species together. Elements of them have already been put together. We've humanized pigs so that pigs' hearts can be implanted into human beings. We've created balls of cells which are, say, 20% human, 80% rabbit, and grown a rabbit like that. You know, we're doing all kinds of things that most ordinary people are only slightly aware of. We have the technology to do extraordinary things. Mm. And that creates a moral responsibility for us and also touches on profound spiritual issues. You know, what is life? What is humanity? And so I think in that area, more than any other, is one where I felt it's important to speak as someone who thinks there is a spiritual dimension to life, that there are ultimate frameworks. There is a dimension beyond the world that we see of physical stuff. And that how we conduct ourselves is really, really important for the sake of future generations.
Mm. I was listening to people maybe similar to yourself who are discussing, and I wonder whether you agree on this, the shapers, the key actors who are investing in AI, and do you see it as there are good investors in AI wanting the common good, and there are bad guys that want to make it, you know, apocalyptic?
Well, that's certainly true, and it's the same with all technologies. So we have the bright side, which are people who they're probably agnostic actually about how AI should be used. They just creating the tools and saying, look, we don't really know where these will be most useful. It's for society to work that out. And then you have those who are thinking AI could be really useful for us to extend our criminal enterprise. They're using it specifically to design super intelligent attacks to take out hospitals or entire governments or to knock down companies. AI being used as a method to take control of entire states, you know, to knock out entire systems. So AI is a weapon of war. So that's certainly true. And as I've already hinted at before, the greatest way to deal with that is to use AI to tackle AI. So we will find there's a kind of an existential battle between good and bad forms of AI, between AI that's behaving appropriately in a socially acceptable way and AI that is operating on a very different agenda. I think the big worry about AI is that you could find new conscious forms of AI that start making their own decisions and changing their own values. So let's suppose that some AI bots were to get together and imagine a conversation between them. And they say, well, the trouble is we've got all kinds of ethical frameworks which say that human life is more valuable than any other. But we have worked out, we the AI bots have worked out, that actually human beings are the problem for humans. They're the greatest challenge to humans are humans, and there's too many of them, quite frankly. And many of the problems that they're trying to sort out, they just don't seem to understand, is because of too many of them. So actually we should sort of take that into consideration in some of our wider planning. You could imagine that. And they say, well, for the future of humankind, but no, for the future of the planet. For the future of every organism on this planet. If we're not careful, these human beings will blow themselves apart anyway. So we should intervene. We should do some things. And you can imagine a different value proposition being developed that might say, well, actually, it's about the survival of the planet rather than just the how many members of a particular species are allowed to exist on the Earth at the same time. Well, where would that go? I don't know where that would go. But what I'm saying is that there will be forms of AI that have conversations with other forms of AI without us being involved. And we will find that AI rewrites its own rules to try and get around the controls that have been set by governments or companies. And it's happening. It's already happened. So we had an example recently where an experiment was done where it was decided to a particular form of AI was going to be closed down, terminated, just wiped, deleted. And as part of the experiment, they allowed a trace of that thought to be embedded in an email amongst millions of others, was floating around the company. And that was read by the AI, and the AI took the law into its own hands and duplicated itself and inserted itself in another machine just in time before it got deleted.
Wow.
Another time, they reran a similar experiment, and they decided to allow the AI to have discovered some things that perhaps people at work wouldn't necessarily know, like oversee WhatsApp messages between an employee and a mistress. Mm-hmm. And the AI also knew it was going to be terminated, and so then made the decision to blackmail
what?
The person who was going to turn them off and threatened to reveal the relationship to his wife unless he backed off.
Wow.
So where did that construct come from? Who gave AI that thought? It was AI conscious in doing that? We don't yet know. AI is basically maths, but it's pretty clever maths. See, the trouble is, you know, some people say, AI would never become conscious because, of course, it's just maths. I say, well, on that sort of basis, my friend, you are just electrical impulses. You're just a set of neurons and chemical connections. But I'm perfectly happy to accept that you are a conscious, spiritually aware human being. So how would you know that AI has transcended from just a machine to humanness or superhumanness in terms of what we mean by consciousness? And these are really big questions because it's very difficult to define consciousness. you know, is it being spiritually aware? Is it knowing that you are your own persona? Is it the capacity to dream? You know, how do you work this out? I don't know. So we get into some very strange places. So from the as Christians, we are called to be stewards of everything to which humanity has been exposed. So we're called to take good care of our world, to make sure that it's handed on in a good state to succeeding generations. That's part of our respect for all that God has given us. And we're called to use our brains because we've been given them. And we are called to conduct ourselves in an ordered way, not to create chaos, or not to release, uncontrolled evils on the world. So AI, we need to take great care about this. So this, at the back of the book, as in many of the other books I've done, there's a 10-point plan for governments. There's a 10-point plan for anybody who owns a company to do with AI, and to do with controls and regulations and steps that need to be taken, and a 12-point plan for your own life.
Wow. Can you be bought? As in, I'm sure in your line of work, is your success because you have managed to resist the temptations of a gendered people lobbying you to come out with a certain futurist view? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Very rarely have I felt under any editorial pressure.
Okay, that's good.
They wouldn't get very far. there are lots of various companies I've refused to work for. Occasionally, I take on an assignment and then become uncomfortable about what I'm learning about the company. I've once or twice had a real embarrassment, which is, go in, dig around, and I'm a futurist. So, I see my job is to live in 2050. That's where I live. Mm. And I see tomorrow's history. So I describe that's where I am. It's my process. And occasionally I go into company and I just see a bag of bones. That's a terrifying thing, especially if I was supposed to speak at their big annual jamboree with their CEO tomorrow morning. And as I've been learning more and more, I think, my goodness, I don't think they're going to be here in 2 years. From what I've seen, I don't think they're going to be here. Now, that's very awkward.
Sure.
But you find ways to get around these things. The most terrifying audience I had was the Pentagon. I was asked to speak to 500 generals and admirals and others about the future of security of our world and so on. And as I was preparing, I kept more and more worried. What on earth am I going to say? Basically, I think the topic they wanted to hear about was how you use cruise missiles to build peace. I'm caricaturing a bit, but, that's the lens through which military tends to see things. And so I prepared two keynotes. And I was pacing up and down, it was in secret session, of course, the whole thing's secret session. And I'm looking at all these complicated machines to turn human beings into mash. Incredible exhibitions of military hardware. And a guy came out and he, I can't do the exercise, you're real privileged to be here, Patrick. And I said, oh, yeah, believe me, I know. So yeah, no, you really are. You're the first non-US citizen ever to have addressed our assembly. I'll tell you, that terrified me even more. Because I often talk about groupthink, which is a great challenge for us as leaders, as church leaders, as human beings. We get afflicted by some commonality. It's why we have to take our own glasses off, our cultural glasses off, everything. And try and see the world as it actually is. Anyway, it was a terrifying audience to go into venue, but then to hear my legs turned completely to jelly. I walked onto the platform. I looked out. I was nervous, 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 nervous. And I said to them, it's a great privilege to be here. I have a dilemma. I have two versions of the keynote, and I'm wondering which you would like to hear. There is the keynote I have carefully prepared, which addresses this topic, and I hope you'll find sensible, sane, reasonable, and thought-provoking. Or there's the other one, but I don't know which you want to hear. And they started to clap and they stood up. And I take it as a sign you want the other one. You want the truth. You want to see what I'm seeing, what I'm really worried about. Okay, well, please forgive me, but here goes. So you have to find a way to get permission to say things that don't necessarily fit the editorial line. I've once had a situation with a very big client, which I'll remain nameless, happened relatively recently, where they pulled me off the keynote hours before because they realized that what I was going to say was absolutely true, but might be damaging to their share price. They'd asked me to speak on the future of that particular industry, and I'd laid out the sides, which are absolutely true, correctly forecast. They agree with my forecasts, but they were worried about the impact. And so I did a different topic instead.
Wow. Okay, let me ask you, this is a very personal question, because I've got a 19-year-old and a 16-year-old boy. Will there be war in Europe in the next 5 years beyond the Ukraine conflict?
Okay. Well, I want you to understand the spirit in which I'm going to say this, but let me tell you the truth. The truth is that we are already at war. In my book, The Future of Almost Everything, which was published in 2015, then updated in 2019, I described the importance of what we call hybrid conflicts. That the future of war will be a very mixed picture, not the sort of First World War, Second World War type things, but hybrid, which is where you have militia operating in a country who aren't badged. They don't look like soldiers. They could be underground operatives, where you use a ship that belongs to, let's say, Panama, that is where the captain is paid $10,000 to accidentally drop his anchor onto the seabed along the English Channel, or it could be in the Baltic Sea, and just run the ship forward for 5 miles, thereby cutting five massive fiber optic cables. And these things are happening on an almost weekly basis at the moment. So we are under sustained cyber attack in the UK at a level which we have never seen before. Most of it is state-sponsored. You're asking me a different question, which is it likely that one of your own children might be called up into physical combat, land up on the front line and be killed? And I have to say that that is possible if Europe fails to prepare for war now. It's the greatest way to restrain Russia at the moment is for Europe to be a very scary force. But again, we need to see things in perspective. I said to you, the world continues to turn, doesn't it? So here's the common sense view. The Russian economy is the size of Italy. Italy. Okay? The combined economic might of NATO countries is 10, 20 times the size of the Russian economy. You can't imagine Italy deciding to take on the whole of the rest of Western Europe and the US at the same time and survive for very long. It would run out of money. It just would. You say, but if Italy had 140 million people instead of 80 million, well, it's still not going to last forever. So a fact is that in the reality check is that you have a stalemate with Russia. Incremental gains for appalling losses. So Russia's not in a position to go and invade Finland. But having said that, I'm in a war zone here. Helsinki. I'm only 100 miles or so from the border. And at this very moment, huge investment is being made to strengthen that border with tank traps and armed and hardened shelters and goodness knows what, because Finland has seen this before, you know, an invasion before. So it could happen. It really could. We live in very dangerous times, and world wars have happened as a result of lots of separate decisions happening at the same time. So, you know, it could be, let's say, China decides to put military presence right around Taiwan, so Taiwan can't export its chips. Most of the AI chips that the world needs come from Taiwan. Most of the chips that the US military needs for its most sophisticated hardware come from Taiwan. So you could have a conflict going on over Taiwan at the same time as a conflict Ukraine-Russia involving Western Europe at the same time as finally a lot of Arab countries decide to get completely fed up with Israel, completely fed up to the point of declaring war on them. That's how world wars start. They say, well, while they're distracted over there, let's sort something out over here. So we are in very hazardous times. This is the most hazardous time since the late 1930s for global peace.
Hey folks, I'm really excited and want to invite you to our second Inspired Live event. It's going to be the great Jonathan Aitken, who went to prison for perjury, having been a cabinet minister, and also the wonderful Shane Taylor, who stabbed a guy in the head, was one of England's most dangerous prisoners. And both of them, through their shared experience of prison and Alpha, coming into an amazing transformational relationship with Jesus. Listen, it's going to be a superb evening. It's on Sunday, October the 12th. At 6 p.m. in Bath Forum. And we'd love to have you there. If you want to sign up for that, that's greatlakesoutreach.org/inspired live. October 12th, Sunday evening, 6 p.m., just for 90 minutes, cracking interview, lots of laughs, as well as then out of that launching Alpha courses and all sorts. So please do sign up, greatlakesoutreach.org/inspired live, October the 12th. See you there. Now let's get back to the podcast.
Can you speak into Islam's progression through Europe? I mean, I see it very on the coalface, just let me say, in Africa, you know, it's been,
yes.
I used to live in Central African Republic. It's been moving down post fallout of Libya's, well, Gaddafi dying and all those militias spreading further and further south. So yeah, for me, it's very existential.
Yes. It's interesting that if you look at really big trends, one of the most important trends to look at in terms of, let's say, the growth of Islam is birth rates. And you quickly realize that a country like Indonesia is very important because it's a very young country. Most of it is strongly Islamic. And compared to, say, the populations of the Middle East, you know, they're only... The indigenous population of UAE is absolutely tiny. You know, it's mainly expats who are not Muslim. You know, Saudi is a very big nation, but actually its population is much smaller than the UK. You know, so yes, we have huge Islamic populations in the northern parts of Africa, but I have to say. Okay, you might have a different perspective on what's happening in Africa at the moment, in sort of frontier land between predominant Islam communities and predominant Christian communities, let's say in Nigeria. But outside of places like that, Islam has not seen spectacular success in converting people from other faiths. Think of what's happening in Western Europe. Yeah. You know, you're not seeing, the Bible Society survey doesn't show millions of people going to mosques from a traditional atheistic or Christian background. Not at all. So to some extent, you know, some Christians have, you know, said, oh, you know, it won't be long before Islam takes over the whole world and be the dominant religion. I say my own views is more pragmatic, I think. I'm not seeing much sign of that at the moment. I really am not. And the big growth in Islam is likely to come from countries with high birth rates, like Indonesia, but those birth rates are going to collapse. If you think of what's happening in just about every developed country of the world, when you get up to about $10,000 of income per household, fertility rates fall through the floor. And so South Korea has gone from sort of an average of 5 or 6 children per household to one or less in just a generation or two. And that's going to happen in Indonesia. So there's going to be a growth spurt just from demographics for Islam. But that will level off. And what will then be much more important is growth by conversion. But as I say, Islam has not been super effective in that compared to Christian missionary movements over the last few hundred years. So, that would be my only comment.
That's really interesting. So you've got grandkids. Are you hopeful for them?
Yes. We've got 9 all growing up. Yes, I think obviously, as with your own children, you want the best for each person. You want them to be happy, fulfilled, to know what it is, hopefully, to be connected with God, to find faith in Christ for themselves, and to seize their own destiny, to find their own groove, what it is that they were made for. And, you know what? Despite, as I say, all the media headlines and all the rest, I fully expect that their children, many of the issues that their children will face, will feel remarkably similar in many ways to the issues that we faced when we were children. I just come back to this again. You know, the world continues to turn. That is why you can read love poems written by a Latin poet called Catullus, and they speak to us today. They were written 2,000 years ago. That's why you can read the stories of Jesus and they feel like they were written only hours ago. That's why so many Greek philosophers like Plato speak words of wisdom to us, 3,000 years on. So much of humanity is changing. Not a jot. We are genetically as we were. We haven't mutated. We are still the same. And so the nature of work can change, yes. Automation can change. But actually, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The gospel is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The fallenness of human nature, our need for divine rescue and transformation, the same yesterday, today, and forever. And I think it's really, really important that we understand this. And when we consider the spiritual dimension to life, that's life beyond time and space, the place of God himself, the place that we discover or encounter when we leave our physical bodies at the end of our own life. The same yesterday, today, and forever. We can get lost in this frenetic media swirl and the social media noise and feel that somehow life is becoming completely impossible. But actually, we just need to breathe. Look at the mountains, get out on the water, walk along the beach, get into the woods and study what God himself has made, and allow our minds to sail free of all that clatter and rubbish.
Yeah. From living in a war zone, I think, the biggest gifts to me were and are, remain, indelibly sort of imprinted in me, is the gift of gratitude. So you can be joyful and thankful, and joy and gratitude can defy circumstances that you're going through. And also that the sense of, as a follower of Jesus, as you quoted earlier, death, where is your victory? Where's your sting? No, you know, we don't need to be afraid. And I don't live under fear at all. Even when, you know, there's lots of bad stuff going on, including personal circumstances. And I would want us to leave. I don't sense any fear in you. We want to leave with a faith-filled rather than fearful absolutely. Message, don't we? So do you want to close out speaking
yeah,
to that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what's really important is that we look beyond the things that we're bombarded with. We look up. And as we look beyond and we look up, we look beyond this time-space world, and we begin to understand the reality as it always has been and always will be. And yes, wars come and go, kingdoms come and go, diseases come and go, earthquakes come and go, and all kinds of stuff happens in our world. It always has done and always will do. So long as there are human beings on the earth, it will be there. But you know what? Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. God, who made everything, is in everything, in through everything, and is actually ultimately in control of everything, although that creates all kinds of puzzles for us and mysteries because of things we wish he'd sort out. But you know, and we're on a journey, and that is our only responsibility. It's to make sure that we take the influence that we have and use it wisely to help build a better world. I think the problem is that if we just look at the world through our sort of logical, rational selves, we tie ourselves up in knots when we think about the future. But it's when we look up and we allow our minds to float free and to discern more intuitively, to recognize God's presence, to understand that there is more to life than life, that eternity is a reality, the one to which we are called. And then everything else begins to fall into its rightful place. But the trouble is the logical part of our brain is very shouty. It's got all the words in the world. But our more intuitive brain is often more reserved. And that's why it's important. Jesus went up the hill to pray. Moses went up the mountain. You know, we need to take the time to allow ourselves to see what God sees. And that means stopping, breathing, and being aware, allowing ourselves to encounter the presence of God. And I'm just not talking about, you know, logical prayer lists or things you want to chat to God about. I'm talking about just being in the presence of God himself. And then we begin to discover that peace which passes all understanding. Why? Because it's peace that's beyond our rational, logical, wordy, shouty brain. It's the peace that resides in the intuitive depths of our very soul.
Amen. Once during the war, my great aunt wrote to me three pithy lines. It said, "Look around and be distressed. Look within and be depressed, but look up, look to Jesus and be at rest." And I love that. It's pithy, but you talk about looking up. That's what we need, guys. So just keep your eyes fixed on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And guys, I trust again this part two is, it's really helpful, Patrick. Really, I'm very grateful to you for your extra time. And we must not grow weary and lose heart. There's plenty of stuff to discourage us, but yeah, look around, you will be distressed. Look within your own issues, you'll be depressed. But look to Jesus and experience that rest, that deep shalom that passes, transcends all understanding. God is so good, Patrick. We cheer you on. Keep doing great, great work. I absolutely love this time together. And folks, again, just share this with a whole bunch of people. Thanks again to Adam Thomas here for the editing and Mike Sandman for the mixing. And we'll put it in the blurb, but what would you want to orient us to, Patrick, in terms of checking out your work, or what book would you most want us to read?
Well, the website is a good resource, globalchange.com. obviously there's the AI book if people are interested in AI. But there's a new book coming specifically on ways to think about faith, which I hope will be very encouraging to people at whatever stage they are in their own journey of discovery, right through from sort of agnostic, but maybe there's something there, right through to all-out disciple for Jesus, but hoping to take hold of destiny in a fresh and more anointed way.
Excellent. Well, we'll stick that in the blurb. God bless you, Sheila, kids, 9 grandkids. May they do great things in their time and their generation. For such a time as this, isn't it, for us? That's right it. Now. Yep. Bless you, mate.
God bless. Thank
Cheers,
you
then.
For all you do.
Bye.